We are welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It is called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. It is an insider look at the NBA and the coaches surrounding the league. Every week, the five-time All-Star and the number one pick in the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall, will give his unique perspective on hot topics in the league and tell the best behind-the-scenes stories from his time in the NBA. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
State Farm Insurance knows that understanding and investing in our cultural identity is paramount in protecting our future. We know what it's like to go from nothing to something, to wish that we had better financial literacy when we were younger. Luckily, State Farm is here to help with funding programs like Project Ready, which is committed to education achievement and has already awarded over $11 million in scholarship offers to Black and Brown youth since 2021. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hey, everyone. It's our favorite time of the year here at The Black Effect. We're heading to Atlanta for the 2024 Black Effect Podcast Festival, and we're not going alone. Nissan is back as our partner, and they're continuing their Pitch Your Podcast Lounge at the festival, where you'll have the opportunity to pitch your podcast idea live and share it with the Black Effect team. So get those podcast ideas ready. And remember, you can count on Nissan to dial up the thrill in your adventures, no matter where life takes you. Visit blackeffect.com/podcastfestival for more details.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream.
Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work. In traffic, so slow.
Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories, change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Wake that ass up.
Early in the morning.
The Breakfast Club.
Morning, everybody. It's DJ Envy, Charlamagne Tha God. We are The Breakfast Club. We got a special guest in the building.
Yes, indeed.
The brother Malcolm Jenkins. Welcome, brother.
Appreciate y'all having me. How y'all doing?
I'm blessed, black, and highly favored. How you doing, my brother?
I'm doing well. Doing well.
Malcolm got a new book out called What Winners Won't Tell You. I love that title. Break that title down.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of the times we see people who have a lot of success, who are champions, and we hold them up high, but oftentimes we don't see, you know, what makes them that way. And oftentimes we kind of glorify that process, and we look at the end, you know, the end result. But for me, I've always been a bridge builder and wanted to make sure that I contextualized the 13-year career that I just finished, you know, all of the things that I've kind of accomplished by showcasing like that journey, that process, that evolution of, you know, a man into what you see now. And really that's, you know, that's, to me, that's what you want to do. That's what you want to live. You want to have impact on things. You want to leave people with breadcrumbs to that mm-hmm. success. And so I kind of open up. The reason I don't have a shirt on the cover is because it's a very vulnerable memoir. It's one of the things where I show kind of the failures, the process, how I developed, you know, into the person I am today.
Nobody likes to show that no more.
You played in the NFL. You former NFL player. Mm-hmm. You got drafted with New Orleans, and yep. then you played for the Eagles.
Boo!
You got that Cowboy. You got that Cowboy shirt on.
Is this shirt like kryptonite to you?
No, not at all. not at all. We know what's going to happen at the end of the year.
You going to the Super Bowl?
I don't know.
He said that every year. Every year he says that, but
this the year.
What year is that ring?
You said that last year.
1996.
You said that last year. Said that last year. Now, what made you want to write this book now? You talk about the winning and the losing and being so open and vulnerable. What made you want to write the book at this time?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things as an athlete, your life is usually documented by other people. Mm-hmm. Everybody else writes about you, talks about you, and we rarely get to hear the athlete talk about their own experience and contextualize it for themselves. I got two young daughters, like, you know, that I think a lot about mm-hmm. what I want to leave to them, how I want them to view me. And so I figured it was better for my story to be told from my own words. So I ended up writing the book myself. You know, cover to cover is all me. And it's one of those things that I'm always involved in everything I do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me, it's one of those things that, again, everybody doesn't get to see what goes into the process, that goes into the mindset, the cerebral parts of not only football, but life, the failures. And I think that that's always been important for the people I know who are watching me to mm-hmm. see that part of it. Because that's the difference. You know, most of the time you'll see somebody at the top and you think you can't get there. You seem so different, you know, so far from your example. And hopefully this kind of closes that gap for the reader to see, like, no, these people who have success are just like you. They go through trials, they go through tribulations. It's those who continue to fight, those continue to play. You know, the idea, you know, that life is this journey. You don't, especially with sports, I think life is like a game. We tend to only enjoy life or the game after we've won. Like mm-hmm. the victory is when you get to enjoy life. But really the winners will tell you that you enjoyed playing the game. Mm-hmm. In life, you have to enjoy where your feet are, enjoy the process, regardless of the results. And really, that's how I've lived my life. That's how I've grown to have success, and I try to live that every day.
I love in the book you talk about a lot of the things you did as far as in the social justice space, because you were the head of the Players
Coalition.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to social justice and being an athlete, what's the balance?
Man, it's, you know, one of the things we had to do was find what our role was, you know, because we're not the experts. We're not devoting our lives to be activists, but we do have a role, you know, as role models and a platform to do something. And I think one of the things that we found to be very useful was to place ourselves as conveners. We can bring, you know, communities to politicians, to police. We can use all of the intention that we get to put pressure on, you know, those who are in power, especially in our local markets. And that's really how we formulated, Anquan Bolden and myself formulated the Players Coalition as a vehicle for athletes all over the country. If you say, I want to get involved, you know, with the things going on in my community, you want to get involved with politics in whatever, you want to lobby, here's the education on the issues locally, here's who you need to push on, here's people of power, and here's some resources to put those things together. So, you know, we kind of worked through that on our own, and then once we figured out the plan or figured out what worked, we just held the door open for anybody who wanted to come. It started with a group of about 12 athletes, and now it's expanded to 12 professional leagues of sports, mm-hmm. Which is far greater than anything I could have imagined when we started it, having impact with, you know, grassroots organizations all the way up to, you know, politics.
What are some of the accomplishments that the Players Coalition did that we didn't hear about?
So the majority of the work was like, hey, all right, talking about the negotiation with the league and things like that. But what we were able to turn that into, you know, so specifically in my focus was in Pennsylvania. One of the things I was most proud of was we pushed for a bill to get passed called the Clean Slate Act. Mm-hmm. And most people don't know, 1 in 3 people in America have some kind of criminal record. Mm-hmm. And so what this did was roll back or expunge those records after 10 years if you hadn't violated for nonviolent offenses. And we were like, you know, that's a low hanging fruit. Let's get that out the way. But that ended up affecting like over 3 million people across the state of Pennsylvania. So that affects how you know, what jobs you can get, where you can live. And it's just, that's a very low hanging fruit when it comes to policy. In New England, guys were doing things. They lobbied to get a bunch of millions of dollars put into the school system to mm-hmm. close the digital divide, getting, mm-hmm. you know, computers and things like that. So these are happening all over the country, Louisiana, Florida, Ohio, all the way to Cali. And it's being done not only by me, but obviously by athletes all over.
Now, when players were kneeling at one time, how did you guys support the players, if at all?
Yeah, well, I was raising my fist. And I was one. That's how the Player Coalition kind of came to about. And I talk about it in the book, mm-hmm. Just about like that moment, everybody wanting to figure out what to do, but not quite agreeing, which seems to be over the time of history a common thread, like people having, you know, the same ideals, a bunch of people being very passionate about, you know, pushing Black people forward or getting involved, but having differences of agreement, you know, differences of opinion and strategy. But my biggest thing was always about the work. I'm like, whoever is about, you know, making a change and putting in the time and effort to do it, let's collaborate, let's work together. And we've been doing that over, you know, over the course of now, coming up on a decade.
I feel like you took a lot of heat back then.
Yeah.
You know, Eric Reed called you a sellout. You know, y'all had y'all, if you watch football, your famous confrontation, mm-hmm. you know, during the game, before the game as well. Like, have y'all been able to have a conversation since then?
Nah, you know, and a lot of people, you know, even in those times were like, hey, man, you need to reconcile that. You need to squash that. But I've always maintained that, you know, I never wanted to be, besides that, and I was very disappointed after that game in myself because I gave the media that image. The last thing I wanted was two black men fighting over, you know, trying to save their people or trying to help their people. That's it's counterintuitive. It doesn't work. And so for me, I've always maintained that, like, I'm proud of the work that they did. I'm proud of, you know, all of us were trying to figure it out at that time. But it's not me. It's not on me to reconcile the situation. Like, I never had a problem. I don't hold any gripes. I was always focused on the work. I knew that regardless of how, you know, I was feeling, the things that were coming down to me, the things that people were saying, my focus was always on the people. I got into this not, you know, to lift myself up. So my feelings didn't matter. It was like, okay, what's the goal here? And it's to help. So all of that to me was distractions. And I had to stay, you know, stay focused on the goal, why I was there, why, you know, I put myself in that position and just maintain.
What was your thoughts on everything that's going on with Colin Kaepernick and everything that's happening right now? What's your thoughts on that?
I mean, it's, you know, it's confusing at this time. It's what, almost 7 years away. You know, it's you almost want him to just kind of like stand on his legacy. I think any the way that it's being approached now and the way that it's being kind of laid out, it almost, you know, it's like worrisome. It makes me a little worried.
What you mean?
I mean, you know, you're talking about, you know, somebody who's once playing in a Super Bowl that's down like begging to be on the practice squad 7 years after later. It's, you know, forget the politics or who he is. Any athlete that's out of the game for 7 years and is still begging to be on the practice squad is concerning to me. It's that now being on the other side of retirement and having to deal with that identity change myself, you know, that's a strong thing that he's dealing with. And you worry about, like, okay, how does one handle transitioning into the next phase of life, the next chapter? Because that one's done. Like, you can't play football forever. So we need to see, you know, what that next example is. And it's with so many people following him, I think we all want to know, like, all right, what's that next move?
You know, some people would say that, you know, he's been playing, similar to you, I'm sure, since you were 3 years old. So that's all that you know and love. And maybe on the bucket list was playing in the Super Bowl or winning a Super Bowl, I should say. So for some people who say maybe he hasn't got that off yet, and then some people would say, you know, like even Charlamagne has mentioned that he feels like that letter was kind of like an embarrassment and a disgrace that, you know, you go from pro athlete to Super Bowl contender to practice squad.
Nah, I don't think anybody want to win a Super Bowl that bad. I don't think it's about the Super Bowl. Because that's not what we're talking about, right? We're talking about just getting on the roster. But, you know, who knows? I think that's the one thing that leaves the concern is we don't know what the motivation is. But I don't know that, you know, one is chasing, you know, a Super Bowl. I think it comes down to and I'm watching it in many teammates of mine. Like even I don't know if you saw Kelsey. Jason Kelsey did a documentary about his life last year. He was trying to decide if he wanted to play or not. And at the end of it, he goes through all of these things that he loves most, his family, his wife, his health. But he is so afraid of moving on to something else. He says, I can't imagine myself being the best in the world or anything else. And so he decides to come back. He's obviously playing again this year. And I watched it. Most people applaud it. I watched it in fear because here you are saying all the things that you value most, you're willing to sacrifice because you're afraid of stepping into the unknown.
Damn.
And I think that's one of the things that, like, I know for me, the opening chapter in my book is fear. I've learned to always, like, step into the things I'm afraid of. And that's how I knew I was ready to step away from the game. Is because the only thing that was holding me there, I had made enough money, my body was healthy, I was focused on other things, but the only thing really keeping me there was the fact that I was afraid to step into the unknown of, you know, I've been playing football since I was seven, same type of thing. But for me, my response is to lean into that. So I think there is a lot of that going on with athletes right now, and I think with Kaepernick being who he is and what he means to, especially our people, I think, you know, we always want him to be the example, but I think it's a great kind of reminder that everybody's human, everybody's dealing with their own stuff.
And oftentimes too, when you don't let go of something, you block a lot of your blessings. You never know what the future is gonna hold if you keep holding on to the past.
Yeah. I never thought I would write a book. Wow. Never in my life thought I would write a book.
Wow.
And it wasn't until, like, you start to let go of these ideas of who you're supposed to be and these limitations we've kind of put on ourselves, and you lean into the unknown and say, well, okay, I can't tell myself I can't do this until I've proven myself, you know, until life proves that I can't do something, I have to always assume that I can. And for me, it's just always about, like, trying to expand, you know, the human experience as much as possible. I'm a forever learner. I'm curious about everything. And the more and more you learn, the more you do, you start to realize, you know, that there are no limitations, that any of the problems that you have in your life, you are going to be the base of that solution. And, you know, and that's a journey. It's not easy to get there. That mm-hmm. takes a lot of trial and error.
I love how you started chapter two. You started it with a quote. We must all suffer one or two pains. The pain of discipline or the pain of regret. Which one did you suffer the most?
I think I suffered both until I learned, you know, the pain of discipline. I think I think I've gotten so much more comfortable in the pain of discipline than the pain of regret. Mm. Both hurt though. And I think, you know, especially when you talk about like even love is one of those things is I've come to find love is like an action word. I take love out as a noun in my vocabulary because we often love in feelings, but to really love somebody or even love yourself, it looks like discipline. It doesn't, we'll look in the mirror and say, I feel good about myself, so I love myself, or I feel confident, so I must love myself. And so we love everybody else with feelings, but when you start to just look at actions, like what are the things you do to love yourself? Okay, do you have discipline with what you eat, how you work out, how you take care of yourself? You know, do you go places you don't need to? Are you reading? Are you cultivating these parts mm-hmm. of yourself? Those things are uncomfortable. They take discipline, but they always expand who you are. They help you grow. They help you go to where you're trying to get to. And I think a lot of the times we try to avoid the being uncomfortable. You know, we try to avoid that discipline and end up just still being uncomfortable with the results because we regretted not having that, mm-hmm. you know, not taking advantage of those times. So for me, I'm always trying to focus on, you know, the end goal, doing those small things daily that starve yourself maybe sometimes with some enjoyment, but at the same time, you know you're moving in a direction you want to go.
Now, you mentioned earlier you had two daughters, and I always ask athletes when they come up here, if you did have a son, mm-hmm. Would you want your son to play in the NFL?
I don't think I would have a desire for him to play. If he wanted to, you know, for sure, I got all the keys to show you how to get there and stay there. And you know, it's a dangerous sport, but everything is dangerous. And I think one of the things about me, my first half of my career, I would get these nagging injuries. My neck, I talk about in the book, I had to get a bunch of epidural shots in my neck. I'm like, I thought those were just for
women pregnant.
Women, yeah, mm-hmm. I was getting them in my neck to play football. You're on heavy kind of anti-inflammatories, things like that. So they're the negative things. But when I stopped trying to hurt people in a game, I stopped trying to punish my defenders, I stopped getting hurt. Wow. Mm. And I played 8 seasons straight with no injuries, which is absurd in the NFL. So there is a way to play the game. There's a way to kind of move about it, take care of yourself that is safe. But obviously, it's a violent sport. But the things that I've learned from playing football are things that, you know, have made me who I am. I think they give me an advantage in any situation. Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about, you know, stepping away from the game and being, since 7 years old, you've been trained to be a leader. You've been trained to problem solve. You've been trained to go through processes, to evaluate yourself, to evaluate your opponent, fail, do it all over again, like live on routine. Like all of those things are things that when you get out into the world, you see regular people, CEOs all the way down, struggle with. Mm-hmm. Yet we've been equipped to do this and been kind of trained to do that. So, I it's a trade-off. You know, I think some of those things are good, some of them bad. It's just up to, if I had a son, it would really be up to him.
Gotcha.
And you know, Tom Brady wrote the foreword of your book. Mm-hmm. Explain that relationship, because I would never have wrote a foreword for Tom Brady.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were looking, obviously we titled it, you know, What Winners Won't Tell You, Lessons from a Legendary Defender. And we're kind of like, all right, well, who do we get to write the foreword? And Tom's name came up, and I'm like, guys, like, I've been trolling Tom about this Super Bowl
exactly
for a few years now. Like, I don't know if Tom is going to write it. But, you know, when I think about, as a defender, who was my favorite opponent, it was Tom Brady. Mm. Love playing Tom. He always brought the best out of me as a player. And, you know, he's the greatest of all time. So I just kind of shot my shot, shot him a text, and he obliged. You know, it was kind of the cherry on top of the book. Definitely, you know, a stamp. I appreciated him for that.
Did y'all have a relationship before that?
Really just a mutual, you know, relationship. Gotcha. Respect as like an opponent, mm-hmm. being peers in the league. But no, we're not like friends. We don't hang out. So this is really just based off of like, I see you, you see me type mm-hmm. of thing.
Now, you said he's the greatest of all time.
I do, yeah.
So you stand by he's the greatest quarterback of all time?
Yeah.
Okay, why?
Because he does the ordinary better than everybody.
Ooh.
Like, I look at Aaron Rodgers, and I'm looking at his skill set. Like, okay, Aaron Rodgers is probably the tougher one to play mm-hmm. because he has a skill set that really nobody else has. Like, on the field, it's hard. But Tom, like, he's not faster than everybody. People have better arm talent. He, you know, there have been other cerebral quarterbacks, but it's like, well, why is he having the success he has? And it's because of his process. He does all the ordinary things better than everybody else.
Ooh.
And I think that to me is like the cheat code of life. Like there's always going to be people with God-given talent, but you master the things that don't take talent and watch how far it goes.
I feel like, man, what you just said makes so much sense, because when you look at the people who have God-given talent, they usually do the basics better than everybody. Mm-hmm. Like they usually do something as simple as practice harder than everybody.
Yeah, I mean, think about, you look at Steph Curry, Jordan, all these
Kobe
people like
Bryant,
Kobe,
yeah.
They talk about practicing.
Yeah.
They don't talk about like, I gotta, you know, I can jump high, so that's, I just jumped over. No, they doing the very simple things over and over and over again, and we only see it in a game, like, oh, this is crazy. And you don't realize he just been doing this same drill since the age of 7.
Right.
And so now it's like clockwork, body, you know, it's a muscle memory. And I think that's something I've always been fascinated in and tried to do myself, is like, what can I, you know, instead of trying to be the best at some God-given talent or do these amazing things, like, how do you just do the ordinary better than everybody else?
Absolutely.
Now, you were just inducted into the Ohio State Hall of Fame, so congratulations.
Appreciate that.
Now, just if you could go back and change it, because, you know, we talk about all the things you stand for now, would you prefer, or would you have rather went to HBCU?
Both of my parents went to North Carolina A&T.
Mm-hmm.
I think going back, no, it was a different time, right? I think right now, the way that there's attention on it, there's people willing to put resources behind the programs and all this happened, of course I would now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think back then, you would have just kind of been selling yourself short. It's like you need the entire environment.
You need the eyes. You need the coaches to come see.
It's not just
you need
one player coming. Mm-hmm. You need the coach. Like what Deion was doing, you know, for HBCUs was a movement. And that's something what we wanted to see. That's what would have made it, you know, appetizing for me as an athlete. And, you know, but I do look at these athletes now who are doing it. Like, I wish the environment was like that when I was coming out.
Mm-hmm.
We have those conversations, man. But I keep thinking, I want people to remember Deion's an anomaly, man.
He is.
Like, Deion was one of the biggest stars in the world. Because it's not like Eddie George is coaching.
Right, right.
You know what
exactly.
I mean? Like, like we could be supporting Eddie George.
It's a few,
It's because it's Deion.
Yeah.
Like, that's what, it's not,
Hugh Jackson's coaching too, right?
I believe so.
I mean, like I said, he's not the only one, but it is the Deion effect for sure. It's not just the on-field stuff and coaching. It's the attention you're bringing, the message that you're bringing, the pride and kind of, you know, the showmanship that you bring to it too. You got to make it cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How did your trip to Ghana influence your advocacy?
Yeah.
Or just change your life, period?
It changed everything. You know, you start to, I think all of us have a bit of an identity crisis at some point. You know, if you're African-American, you want to know where you came from. And at the lowest point in my life, it was like one of the most critical moments in the book. I needed to get away. And I was like, I always wanted to go to Africa. So I went to Ghana, and it was just to be around something, you know, a place that's all black for a week and a half. I didn't realize how much I needed that until I came back. I was like, I hadn't even thought about being black for a week and a half.
Mm.
And I was like, that must be what white privilege feels like.
Man.
And I'm like, oh, you know, it's like you didn't realize you needed those spaces to get away. And so just going to the
slave castles,
the door no return, you just feel this connection with your ancestry that I hadn't had before. And even just nature and all of those things. So for me, it was life-changing, changed my perspective of like what's important, what's my role here. Like I don't strive to have success in this kind of like American society. It's like I'm here for a purpose. I'm live here. This is what I call home, but I don't have to buy into the ideology. You have something before slavery now to tap into, a history to explore. And I think that was mentally liberating for me.
Did you take your daughters?
No, they haven't been yet. We've been to the continent. We were in like Northern Africa, Morocco, Marrakesh, but they haven't been to Ghana yet.
Yeah, I took all four of mine, and my 7-year-old, she's 8 now, but she literally was like, where are the white people at? Like, is that noticeable?
Yeah. I talk about it in the book, the only white face I saw was Jesus, and they have him. White Jesus is everywhere. It's crazy. But I did bring, I brought my two brothers, brought some of my frat brothers. I've been there like 4 times. The last time, and we closed out the book with it, is the time I bring my parents. They always wanted to get to the continent, and so I bring them bring them with me, and they had a blast.
And the brother got to go because he got TV this morning too. So you got to pick up the new book.
Oh yeah, definitely.
What winners
yeah.
won't tell you. We appreciate you joining us, brother. We appreciate you. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Appreciate y'all having me for sure.
Pick up the book right now, Malcolm Jenkins. It's the Breakfast Club. Good morning.
Wake that ass up
in the morning.
The Breakfast Club.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories, change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Got my Prevnar 20 shot. It's a pneumococcal pneumonia vaccine. For us, wise folks, it helps protect.
I'm 19, strong.
And asthmatic, and at higher risk. Get vaccinated.
But
nothing when grandma speaks.
Grandson listens.
19 or older with chronic conditions like asthma, diabetes, or chronic heart disease, or 65 plus, you may be at higher risk for pneumococcal pneumonia. Prevnar 20 can help protect you with just one dose.
Prevnar 20 is approved for adults to help prevent infections from 20 strains of the bacteria that cause pneumococcal pneumonia. Continued approval may depend on a supportive study. Don't give Prevnar 20 if you've had a severe allergic reaction to the vaccine or its ingredients. Adults with weakened immune systems may have a lower response to the vaccine. Side effects include pain and swelling at the injection site, fatigue, headache, muscle, and joint pain. For full prescribing information, please call 1-855-213-2138 or visit Prevnar20.com.
Ask your doctor or pharmacist about getting vaccinated with Prevnar 20, even if you've already received another pneumococcal pneumonia vaccine.